future before it's too late.
Try better next time. That's Placebo here on Radio 3. Off we go to St Kilda High Street and check out Morris Misolowski. How are you?
Yeah, happy Tuesday, everyone. And was that a subtle hint, Phil?
Have you got a high street
Should
there?
I try
that was my
immediate
my question. Have you got a high street in St Kay?
No, but in the next suburb up we do. And it's a very, very upmarket high street. Very expensive clothes.
I bet it is
and
now.
And other shops.
Yay. Yeah. So, morrisfuturist.com. I like checking out his articles every Tuesday before we go on the air. There's an interesting one, very interesting one this week, which I know it's right up your strata. Digital twinning. Digital living forever. And my sort of layman's question, really, Morris, was how long do you think before all of this wonderful technology we're discovering, particularly in the world of medicine, is going to have an effect on skin and bones?
I think it already has, Phil.
Okay.
I mean, it has at the higher end because a lot of the innovations, inventions, things that we have seen, and COVID's a really good example of that, going back to that horrible C word, really did come about because of this digital twinning. They were able to trial a whole lot of different things and different purposes mm-hmm. on a whole lot of virtual patients and make leaps and bounds in ways that they wouldn't have had to do before, or wouldn't have been able to do before, I should say. Mm. So we've already seen it. It's definitely not every day, but it is getting closer to that in the labs, in the high end of town. It's still expensive technology. It's still clumsy. It still is all of those things. And what we're talking about is the possibility, the really strong possibility now, of everything that we do physically. So that's walking, talking, driving, breathing, heartbeats, all having a digital twin or a digital replica,
yeah.
Something inside of our screens that mimics it almost perfectly. And that's the difficult part, almost perfectly, but we'll get better and better through the years until we have to ask ourselves the question, is that the real Phil or is that the virtual Phil?
Okay, so halfway through that explanation, which was very clear, I'm thinking to myself, so we're using AI, digital twinning, digital immortality, if you like, that's what he writes about as well, as a sort of what if, so we can test out all the possibilities and then scoot them over to me.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. So one of the big purposes of that is exactly that, to do the what ifs, to trial it, to not have to use mice and all those things that we used to use in labs, not have to try something on a human because we think it should work for them. Because in best intents and with the best doctors, they really don't know if it'll work on me as against you because we're all different physiologically.
Mm.
And with a digital twin, it should not be too long from now before we can give a vaccine to me and a vaccine to you digitally. And make sure that it hasn't caused us any harm, done exactly what it says on the label, and then if that works, give it to us physically. But this also goes much further than that. It talks about this whole nonsense you and I have talked about for the last year and a half or so, artificial intelligence,
yeah.
AI, and it goes to the strong possibility, I mean, it is a certainty, but whether we want it or not is not a certainty, that everything that you and I do, and that's euphemistically, everything that we do, anyone that has a mobile phone, anyone that goes online, anyone that has anything to do with this internet thing, is leaving little breadcrumbs behind of who they are and what they've said and where they're going and what they've bought. And that list goes on and on and on. And artificial intelligence is getting really good at stitching together those little breadcrumbs and saying, well, you know, this isn't a bad facsimile of what Morris has done today, where he's eaten, where he's been, what he's thought about, because I know he's doing all these things. So if I can pretend to be him, would I fool people into believing it actually is him?
That still falls into the realms of sort of slightly sneaky-beaky stuff. I love it when you get into medicine. I think that's what I'm thinking about really today. You know, there was a hospital drama on some time ago where they had this incredible supercomputer on steroids in the operating theatre, and it would give suggestions and stuff. Now, I'm assuming that is real because they wouldn't totally make that up.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely real. Again, cutting edge, but absolutely real. We put into that the notion of robots doing operations, which, again, is very real. And we're not talking about, you know, the R2-3-2 doing it on its own, the robot and a human in a operating theatre, and that's it. We're talking using these as tools.
Mm.
And to your example, the robots now, which primarily are an extension of a human hand, used by humans behind the microscope, and the reason humans don't do it or prefer not to, and I've talked to some cutting-edge, bleeding-edge doctors who are really the best in brain surgery, the best in all of their fields, really cannot be topped, have done incredible research. And almost to a person, they've said the same thing, that these robots to them are almost a gift from on high. Not because they want to stop doing what they're doing, because they love it, but because what it does is allow them to be absolutely pinpoint accurate, which of course their hands are able to do, but the slight tremor of a hand or something can really, of course, set that operation off.
Do they deal in probability a lot, these machines, as well?
Well, they do, but robots can be pre-programmed. They can be taught over and over again to be absolutely millimeter perfect, which is why when you do brain surgery, for instance, and that's so important, of course, that many physicians now will want to have by their side as an assistant, not as an entire activity, but as an assistant, to have an operating robot next to them so they can get that millimeter perfect, which has been trained on a virtual brain, for instance. So you can actually, and this is being done, you take all the virtual scans, all the activities of that person's brain that you're about to operate on over a period of time. Of course, physicians, doctors would be studying that, as they always have and always will, ongoing, to make sure that they have pre-planned the operation as best as possible. But they're also able now to feed that into artificial intelligence, to feed it into a set of hands that are attached to robots, and for them to pre-play that operation and to trial it, you know, if this goes wrong, if that goes wrong, before they even touch a human.
Right.
And then when everybody's really happy, to program that in both for the human, in other words, the doctor knows exactly what she or he's going to do, what they need to do, and everything else, and the operating robot also works with them. Artificial intelligence kind of bridges between the two of them, and then they set off to do the most extraordinary surgeries.
Let's bring in the AI thing here. So basically, can it communicate with the surgeon during the procedure?
I've not seen it actually talk to a surgeon. I don't know whether surgeons would want it to do that, but it can certainly guide. So I've seen it do that, and it does it often, much like our car does when we program in an address and it tells us where to go. You can see that surgeons who wear particular glasses, which have, you know, mixed reality inside of them, if that's what they choose to do, or through the microscope, the laser will actually guide them efficiently where to be and what to do and where to cut and the rest. So I've seen that, but I've not seen it talk to it before. It could, and maybe it does do that, though.
Yeah, well, that's sort of my very loose thing today. When does it actually impact on, you know, your auntie actually living longer? Let's refer to your article here, Maurice. So, digital immortality, what happens when you outlive yourself? He's on MauriceFuturist.com. First para, imagine sitting on your couch, sipping tea, while another version of you attends a business meeting on the other side of the world. This isn't cloning, time travel, or some sci-fi movie plot. It's the future knocking, and it's knocking loudly. Take us further.
It's one of those thought pieces which I think we really do have to start thinking a lot about. It might seem science fiction, and yes, it's based on it, but the reality is, as I've said, these breadcrumbs that you and I are leaving all over the internet, if we stitch them together, and we will and we are over the next year or two, that's all that's going to be, and we create digital replicas of us, and there are already sites that can do that. So if you go to something like Synthesia, that will actually be able to build a virtual replica of you, face, voice. You can teach it your voice, for instance, within about 30 seconds, and it will be able to mimic your intonations and everything else about you. It takes a bit longer for it to be perfect, but 30 seconds you get a fairly good facsimile of it. If we can get a facsimile of the way that you look and also of your voice, and yes, there are a whole lot of issues we have to ask about that. I'm not skipping over them for a second. There are ethics, there are all kinds of horrible humans, I know, and that's why I've set this piece out, because I want us to pre-think these things. I want us to say what is right and wrong and to set some road rules before these things just go into the capitalist sphere of because we can, they are. We really do need to get very, very sensible about these things before we let the genie out. But if we know that those things are happening and that they can happen, the technology is there for them to happen, and that you and I, even if we don't mean to, are really forming images of ourselves online, is that a good thing? How long does that live? Does it live beyond us? Does it live independently of us? One of the things that concerns me is who owns the digital version of me. We always thought that what we put up in Facebook or LinkedIn or whatever was owned by us. They were our thoughts, but they aren't. They're owned by the medium that we choose to share them on. So who owns that digital version of me?
Way past the point of no return now, Maurice, isn't it?
Yeah. And where do we store them, Phil? I mean, who has the rights to use them? I talk about benign things, which is always my preference. And many months ago, we talked about an article I wrote for my granddaughter about wisdom for the next 120 years. This could absolutely be a version of that. And many years ago, it really does go back about 10 years ago, somebody built what was then called a dad bot. And that was before apps and things became really popular. His father, unfortunately, was passing of a disease. It was imminent. There was nothing they could do. They were all well aware of it. He was a software engineer, and he decided he would record his father in the last few weeks of his life with his father's absolute permission, and they filled it to the brim with all kinds of saying, thoughts, much like my 120-year piece. The father that was passing really just put everything down that he could think of.
Yeah.
And then when he passed, the son, and there are still articles about it, still uses it with the family. When he wants to have a conversation with his dad or know what his dad would say or think about it, he uses this bot that he built to do it. Is that something that we want to do? Do we want to have a digital legacy?
Is that creepy, Morris?
I think it really is about the individual and the culture and the religion to answer that question. For some people, it's not. For some people, they talk to their ancestors. It's part of the culture of the society or the way that they live. I don't mean physically or talk to them, but they always include them in conversations, believe there's still spirits around them. I don't know, Phil, and that's why we need to have this discussion ongoing, because we need to preempt these things because they are and can be done. When you're Elvis, when you're Michael Jackson, these decisions are very different. And I'm saying that because they already have digital images of them who are standing on stage and who are playing to audiences. ABBA, they're all alive, but they have a digital version of themselves that are playing to packed audiences. One may be coming to Melbourne. At the higher end, where these things make profit, it's kind of been talked about and kind of been decided, but that doesn't mean it's true for you and I.
Well, he's talking about what can your digital self do, and of course in his article he gets into this. The one I just read out is interesting. Sit in meetings you don't have time for, your voice, your reasoning, your charm, without you lifting a finger.
Yeah, and we do that every day now, not in meetings, but if you think about it, we often go online when we're talking to something online, like a shopping portal, and we're talking to a bot or something on the right-hand side, we're asking a question about delivery or whatever else, we're talking to a virtual version of the person we think is there. Many of us might think that it's an actual person, but it's not. It's a bot who's been taught to answer in a way that makes sense according to the circumstance. We're already doing it. We just don't really think about it in the way that we're discussing it.
That makes an awful lot of sense. So we sort of do tend to stick into the area of medicine, but that is the obvious area to question, isn't it?
It is, but I also think you can push this into law.
Okay.
It would be fascinating to take this into a law-type capacity where we have some of the best brains, some of those lawyers that charge a squillion, but who really do know their material. Could we get a virtual version of them to not adjudicate, not make law, but to give advice that's far cheaper than what we have now? Can we get really great teachers that are based in Hong Kong that are doing extraordinary work to virtually work in Melbourne at the same time or in Los Angeles or in some developing nation? In other words, make them available to everybody. Khan Academy is a great example, K-H-A-N, which is a series of videos that have been created, firstly by Khan, who taught maths but now been spread out. So, again, we have precedents of these things, and I think what we're talking about could play itself out into all these spaces, not just medicine, and I'm almost sure it will in the next decade or so when these things become ordinary.
Do people still kick off the way they used to with all the moral and ethical objections? There's a beautiful film doing the rounds now called Joy, starring Bill Nye, and it's about IVF and Patrick Steptoe. And when that happened in 1969, there was uproar, wasn't there?
Yes, and I only watched that last night, Phil, so I'm so thrilled you mentioned it. It was a wonderful film, truly wonderful film, and it made me think of exactly what you've just said, that it is, to many people, and I would be one of them, I think it's the most incredible advance that we could do for humanity, giving the possibility of children to those that were unable to before.
But they got so much trouble.
At the start of this, as with every new technology, it was held down. I love to use the example on stage. You know, we all take electricity and gas for granted now. But literally 110 years ago, if you go to the front of the New York Times, if you talk to many people, not people, but if you read the writings of people from the pulpit or others, they were decrying electricity and gas as the devil's work and not to bring it into your home because of all the ills it would bring about. Yes, Phil, it's pretty much what humans do when we're not comfortable or sure about something.
Do we still do it, Morris?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I can tell you, every day of my life, in every conversation, everybody goes to the sinister and the terrible and the we can't and we shouldn't. And I just sit there and wait for that breath to finish and then go on and try and do what we're doing now.
It opens a very deep conversation because people tended, I don't know if they, well, they probably still do, use the two words, playing God. Boy, that opens Pandora's box, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It absolutely does. I mean, I don't know how to define that because I don't know who's we're talking about or what it means to play it. But regardless, you're absolutely right, and that's what it seems to be. I was told by somebody who was very religious a very long time ago, and I don't hold this to be gospel. I know that's a play on words. But what he said is if it is the hand of God, then God has given the hand to create these things.
Oh, see?
You could play that side of it as well.
It goes on and on and on and round, doesn't it? It was really interesting, though, that the medics sort of said, you know, women everywhere have got a new chance. And then, obviously, many other people, notably older ones, were saying the playing God thing. I mean, what a wacky conversation that is. And it won't go away.
It was absolutely correct in its time, though. And I'm sure that many, many people still feel that way because IVF is not universally accepted by all. But it certainly is a technology, I think, that deserved to come about and deserves to be used by those that want to. For many of these things, there is no compulsion. And that's one, again, we've talked about this often. I don't think it's compulsory to do anything like this, but it would be wonderful to have the option to do it if you wanted to. We've talked before about these digital being a wonderful facsimile for those that have lost their voice who are ill or who can't speak for themselves, who can't perhaps give that last thought of whether they do or don't want to continue on. If we could somehow get a digital version of ourselves, maybe to carry some of that load for those types of people, maybe that's an honourable and great thing to do. I don't know. We'd have to do side. So there are reasons and purposes for these things to occur. And this digital thing is not going to go away because we believe it to be ill or terrible, because it's here right now. Let's decide if we want it or not, how best to use it or not, and then build some rules around this thing and make sure that the people whose facsimiles are used, who their voices and faces are used, are the people who want their faces and voices used and whatever thoughts they have.
Obviously, his article goes into a lot more detail than we have time for today. MorrisFuturist.com. Go to the blog. He wraps up by saying, does your digital self evolve? How human should it be? What does it mean for humanity? Just have a look and see what you think. Thank you, Morris. Absolutely brilliant. We'll talk next week all the way from Aussie. Let's get into the